the issues were longstanding. That was good.
Right. And, you know, having that first day for people to sort of get over their predispositions and positions really allowed us to move forward. So I was very pleased with that meeting.
Yeah.
A good meeting.
Yeah, there aren't many meetings as productive as that one.
I
have to say.
I'm trying to sign on the WebEx here, so.
Hi, sir.
So how is everybody today?
Great.
Great. That's how I feel. Everything is just falling into place. So Tina's on and Michael's on.
Bill and Dale.
Sarah.
Elizabeth.
Bill Dunty and Dale Harold. You guys have a PASS meeting coming up, don't you?
Yep, we do, tomorrow.
Kathy and Scott are here.
Kathy and Scott.
This is Jeff Wozniak.
Jeff Wozniak, how are you?
I'm doing well.
John is here.
John Hannigan, a long time.
Bill Barnett.
Bill Barnett, you're not supposed to be on here. You're supposed to be traveling.
I am traveling, and I'm here.
Wow, you multitask.
By locating.
Jennifer, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, Ken Jones?
He's not going to be on.
Okay. Sarah's here. Tatiana Farood. Peter Hammond. Deepak. Susan Tapert. That's about it. I guess Tatiana's going to be a little late, but she's supposed to be on, and Deepak's always late. So, all right.
Kristen Jepson with Tina Chambers is here, too.
Yeah, you guys.
I'm not one of your usuals.
Yeah, you guys got a big thing going on today. So how much time are you going to need? That's all what I need to know.
I think we can do it in 30 minutes or less.
Okay. Someone else just joined?
Yeah, it's Tom at NOFAS.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Ed.
You getting all ready for your big gala?
Oh, yes. Yes, we are. Looking forward to it.
Sorry, I think I'm going to bail on that. So
I saw your note, Ed. Of course, understand that and your schedule, and we hope to see you soon.
I would have liked to have gone to try to, you know, do a little lobbying. And I know you're going to have a big name there, but I'm sure you can handle it. And outstanding job.
No, we're looking forward to it. It's shaping up pretty well. I think we'll have maybe, you know, 8 or 10 members of Congress and another dozen ambassadors and. A very good representation on internationally with what's going on with the issue.
All right. Well, I want you to tell the Italian ambassador that I'm trying to get Italian citizenship.
Well, you're over there often enough, right?
I'm going to try to get it, you know. So I expect his full support. All right.
Well, next time you're here and you have a moment, we'll go see him.
Okay. All right. Someone else join? Tatiana?
Peter,
how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
And if you could stay on after this is over, I need to talk to you about something.
Okay.
If you have time.
I have time.
All right. Okay, so let's get started. The first thing I want to do is, Elizabeth, I don't know how many of you saw the comment section in Nature August 14th, about don't blame the mothers, in which the comment was made that today fetal exposure to crack or cocaine is considered no more harmful than exposure to tobacco or alcohol. The criminal prosecution of pregnancy drugs continue And the article kind of takes exception to the hazards of prenatal alcohol consumption in some respects. And but it's about the careless discussion of early life health affecting generations and how that impacts women. And Elizabeth wrote a very nice commentary and then got input from Michael and myself, and I understand that our letter to the to Nature is going to be published in another week or two.
Yeah, it's supposed to be September 11th. That's what they're shooting for.
So I want to thank Elizabeth for doing that and taking the lead on that. She did a really nice job, and Michael for his insightful comments.
Absolutely. Team effort. I had a bee in my bonnet to get it out there, but it was great to have the two of you to help tone
it. It all came together real quick, and, you know, unfortunately that doesn't happen very often when we comment about things related to FAS. They usually come out, you know, months after the original article, so this one's good, and thank you.
You know, my media relations people are saying, well, we don't do much with, you know, correspondence letters to the editor, but maybe we could develop a larger sort of letter to the editor to some, you know, parent magazine or something that might get broader attention than a note in Nature.
Yeah, and, well, I'm going to bring up another thing is that, as all of you know, September 9th is International FASD Awareness Day. So I think that many of us have things planned for that day, and maybe the media relations could use that day as a way of slipping this comment or reply to this comment into the public forum a little bit more.
But if it's coming out on September 11th, I don't know if we're allowed to do that.
I know you asked him if it was embargoed, so.
And I didn't get a response. I'll find out, though.
Okay. Because, I mean,
it's not embargoed. Could you share that with us? It might be useful.
Yeah, I do not know if it's embargoed, but I will try harder to find out.
Okay, so, but I think that, you know, FASD Awareness Day, and Tom and Kathy have done a great job getting out a media campaign to try to get this out, and I hope all of you have looked at their site for September 9th and have planned to participate in some of the posters and the media. I know that Jennifer is working on that here and has a bunch of things planned for our involvement from both CFAS and CBT. Anybody has anything? Just want to take a minute and tell us about it. That would be great, what your plans are for September 9th. Oh, fail me now.
So our state of North Carolina has an FAS collaborative group, and we have an activity planned in Charlotte, which is sort of a takeoff on the NoFAS UK's Pregnant Pause activity. And so we'll be doing that at 9 o'clock on next Tuesday morning.
Anyone else?
This is Tina. We're doing a kind of a reception open house with our parent support group on the 9th evening, and then we have our group is going out distributing the coasters and getting sign-on from the bars and restaurants, and then there'll be a press release coming out from UCSD about that event and the FASD International Day on, I think it comes out on the 8th.
Excellent. For anyone who's never been in San Diego, SDSU has this gigantic billboard on the freeway, and so I think Jennifer's arranged to have it acknowledged there, and that gets a lot of play all the time because the traffic's horrible and people have
and everyone has to
look at the billboard. So that'll get some play. But I would encourage all of you, and I think Tom has certainly sent out a sufficient number of emails, or Kathy has, about the events that NOFAS has going on and the supplies and things that they will make available. There are posters and lots of different pamphlets to help make this day. And Diane Black in the UK is trying to get a large multimedia attention because they have an ad campaign coming out by a group that does commercials, which are internationally known for their quality. And so please go to the NoFast website and look around and see what you can find about what you might be able to do to participate in September 9th.
And Ed, this is Tom. Could I also mention that NIAAA and NOFAS are doing a Twitter chat on the 9th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and that's at hashtag NIAAA chat. So that's yet another thing that we're going to be doing that day and throughout the month in recognition of International FASD Awareness Day. And anyone can just drop me a line if you have any questions, you know, rather than trying to work through the NOFAS website or something. But if you had any questions and just want to directly ask what we're doing in terms of news advisories and then materials, please let me know.
So, Ed, this is Rajesh, and I interact with a group called the Texas Office for the Prevention of Developmental Disabilities, and they have plans for outreach for clinicians and healthcare personnel in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and the Houston area. There's going to be activities there, training activities. And then I did in the Bryan College Station area, we have something called Cafe Scientifique, where faculty from A&M talk about different issues, and I talked about fetal alcohol at that forum.
I think we're all doing more attention. I mean, my problem is I've never tweeted anyone how to do it. But get in touch with Tom if you have questions about that. Also, NOFAS is having their gala reception on the 17th, I believe, of this month. If anyone has, they'd like to donate to NOFAS to make that they're having a silent auction. That would maybe help them out. I don't know, Tom, if you're still taking donations or not. And I don't hear them. So, but you may want to consider doing that. All right. Really interesting meeting in Washington, D.C. last week about the criteria as part of a COFAS meeting that both Phil May and Dina Chambers are involved in. And it was an extremely productive meeting. Tina, do you want to just kind of take minutes? I don't want to cut into your web next time. So,
I think it was a really worthwhile thing. What, you know, some of the issues that had arisen as we're getting towards the end of doing the estimation of the prevalence of FASD. Of course, the classification criteria come up, and we had initially proposed to use the revised IOM criteria as laid out by Gene Hoimy. And, you know, sitting in the room, there was certainly, on Gene's part as well as others, concerned that set of criteria was fine in its time, but needed to be updated. And so in a very efficient manner with discussion about what how this aligns with the NDPAE description that's in the DSM-5 and how this applies sort of practically in establishing prevalence estimates, we came up with a consensus of some additional criteria or modification of the criteria, which I think Gene is in the process of writing up as a revision of the revision.
Michael, you have anything to add? I think we're losing people.
I'm in the car and I was on mute, but I would just second that having to establish the prevalence of a disorder really requires that you pay close attention to how you define the disorder, and I think that this meeting was very successful in bringing a lot of expertise to the table, and really, I think helping Gene to finalize his thoughts with the input from the group on how this will be defined. I think that the major change is that there were no behavioral elements required for the diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome. And in looking at individual cases, which was part of the exercise we went through, it was very clear that there could be children who were neurodevelopmentally normal, except that they were of small stature and born appearance of small stature, who happened to have the face, which they found is about a 25% false positive rate. In other words, in their control group of children without prenatal alcohol exposure, they could get two or three elements of the face in up to a quarter. So that meant that children born of parents of small stature who have the defining facial malformations could be misdiagnosed. And so the element that really will be added, both the FAS and partial FAS, is the requirement for some neurodevelopmental abnormalities. The details of those are being worked out, but I think that was a significant change, which will I think alter a little bit how we go about making the diagnosis.
Yeah, I thought it was a good meeting, and I think a lot of useful thought went into it and came out of it. Article to come out now. As you all know, CFAS is presenting a half-day session at the Vancouver meeting. It's going to be March 4th through 7th in Vancouver, B.C. And we have urged other investigators in CFAS to possibly go to this meeting and present. And if anyone is doing that who's not in one of the in the CFAS half-day session, you know, that would be great. And who wants to do it? It's past the abstract submission time. But
Ed, it's Sarah. I'm still working with Christina to track down a topic for a session.
Okay. The abstracts are past due, but we might be able to still get anyone in who wants to attend that meeting and present. And it's a great meeting because, you know, it's probably about 1,500 people, and people who do basic science get to interact with people who either have an FASD or interact with individuals with FASD on a regular basis. So it's great to see what you're studying and to find out what their concerns are. And, you know, the theme this year is integrating research policy and promising practices. And they are very much interested in basic research and how that can be applied. So if anyone's interested, please get in touch with me as soon as possible. Tatiana, are you on yet? All right. Bill's there. And Bill sent out a data access policy update. I don't know who's had a chance to look at it, but I want to thank the committee that worked on that. It's Bill Barnett, Tina, Tatiana, Sarah, Elizabeth, and Bill Dunty. And I was very pleasantly surprised by together, and hopefully you'll all have a chance to look at it and make any final comments, and then this will become the data sharing policy of CFAS. And it's important that we do that. It's an NIH requirement. Any comments directed to Bill about this?
That's right. And a little context, Ed, just shortly, is that this is designed to be something that will go up on the CFAS website that will guide people for basically the rules of the road for using CFAS data for their research projects. There'll be a much longer data use agreement that will have a lot more detail that we'll be working on next, but we wanted to get this language.
Yeah, I think you did a fantastic job on this. I do have a question for NIAAA, though. Oops. Hold on. It ends with the statement that if you use the data, it says, we acknowledge the support of NIAAA and the support of the CFAS Administrative Corps and the CFAX Informatics Core, and then they list the grant numbers. As you use data from particular research projects, you're required to acknowledge those projects as well. I have a question. If someone uses and acknowledges those grants in a publication.
Hey, sorry, I got kicked off.
Oh, yeah, I was wondering what happened to you. I'm asking a question about the last thing about the acknowledgement of the two grants, the Admin Core and the Informatics Core.
Yeah.
And this is to NIAAA, that if those grants are acknowledged, does that put us in jeopardy if the individuals who use the data don't put their publications in that correct format and on PCMID or whatever it is, that our funding could be jeopardized if they don't do that?
Ed, Bill. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
This is Dale, everybody. So my take on that is when you need to comply when you report an NIH-funded publication in progress reports and the progress report components of grant applications. So that's what really triggers the policy. So you need to be prepared for that if they're your own papers. I don't see how someone just citing your grant number will set that in motion and have unwind on you.
Well, I had the instance where a former trainee referenced a training grant and did not have his publications in the correct whatever. And our funding on that training grant was going to be held up until we took care of that. And this was a guy who graduated like 3 years ago, but he acknowledged that he did the work while he was a trainee. And, you know, we didn't have any contact with him or anything. It was just put us in some jeopardy without any real, you know, whatever.
Did you say that it was triggered by him submitting some form of application?
I don't know. I thought it was one of his publications, but that he might have put online, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it did get triggered. Jill, do you have any better recollection?
We ask for a list of the publications, and the trainees had listed that one. And in our list, then, that was reviewed by NIAAA, it came up as a problem.
So he gave it to us for our progress report. We put it in, and because it wasn't
– not compliant, yeah.
It was not compliant, we had to deal with it in a very quick manner to get our funding continued. So I just, you know, I just worry about that. So.
I'll be in touch with Jill and make sure I understand all the details and ins and outs of it. But
yeah, I guess if they're just putting in a publication, we'll be fine. But I just didn't know the rules about that and how they pick up those grants, whether they search acknowledgement sections or what. But all right, so I think.
But might it help simply to add that as a requirement?
Yeah, but that's the hard part to. Make them do it, John.
I mean, it already is a requirement of their grant.
Yeah. It's just difficult to, you know, I heard of a case where someone passed away and they had an issue because they couldn't do it, you know, even though they'd cited a grant. So I don't know. But I think we need to look into it. I don't about whether it's us triggering it or whether a publication triggers it.
When you submit a publication, and please correct me if I'm wrong, when you submit a publication, a paper for publication, you list your grant sources. When, as it goes through the, after it's accepted, you will start getting emails asking you to confirm the grant funding of that publication. If, as the author, you list a CFAS grant, then it goes, I think, the email then goes to the grant holder to say, do you approve? Or is this correct? And you would know because if we put in papers recently that I listed the administrative core, wouldn't you get an email saying your grant has been listed? Do you agree?
I think I do. Not all.
Yes.
But sometimes. So.
I don't know. Maybe that's not relevant here, but there's some process.
So, you know, it's just that we have to be sure that whoever, if they do that, then indeed they make sure that they become compliant with the NIH on their publications.
Yeah, well, I think John's right. We could put that as a requirement.
Yeah, well, I'll look into it a little more on this end, but it might also be something that we can address in part with language. Maybe a statement saying, you know, you must say this utilized data that was gathered under previously funded NIH grants, blah, blah, blah. Some way of making it not look like the paper itself that is triggering things was funded by your grant.
Sort of two steps removed.
Yeah, I like to be removed.
So we could not list grant numbers and refer to CFAS and refer to NIAAA. And we could also, if there's a generic publication that we would like to have cited in the acknowledgement, that's another way to go also.
Yeah, I think if Dale can look into that and find out exactly what triggers it, then we can decide on the policy, whether we just say acknowledge CFAS without putting the grant numbers and go from there. All right. Well, I don't want to cut into Tina's time because I know they have several speakers. We still need to address the publication policy, which I hope everyone also looked at, and that's available on the CFAS website. And Tatiana's not on, so I can't get her update on it. So, but again, I want to thank that committee for looking into that. And
Ed?
Yeah.
Tatiana, I think, is on.
I'm on.
Oh, all right.
It keeps saying mute on, mute off. I don't know why it's doing that. I'm not pushing any buttons.
I had to do it because you had a lot of keyboard noise.
All right. Well, I want to thank Jennifer, Sarah, Kathy Sulik, Dale, Bill, and Jill for working on this publication policy. And, Tatiana, you just want to take 2 minutes?
I do. I don't know that I need to say a whole lot because we did this last month. And so I guess the main things are, I mean, we've walked through the documents and we took everyone's comments into account. We've got really nice templates that can be done on the web, and there's a flow chart that walks you through the process. And I don't know, I'm sorry, I'm on a computer that can't show me WebEx. So I think the main thing is if you can show the flow chart on the WebEx, that might be nice. The nice thing about the process, I think, is we're going to discuss these and just mention them at the beginning of these calls. It's really an onus on us to indicate when we want to participate and when we feel we can significantly participate in a project. We need to contact and comment on that proposal. That's the way we become authors. That's the way we contribute to papers. And so if we don't do that, then, you know, it's not a given thing. You indicate what it is you want to do, and then what happens then naturally is that's our way to identify co-authors. And then when it comes back to our manuscript review, it's actually a very perfunctory process, making sure acknowledgments are correct, making sure, you know, the people who said they wanted to be authors and had a way to contribute actually, you know, did do that, and it's all indicated. And then if somebody wants to get a review to improve quality of paper, we're offering that as part of the manuscript kind of review process. So I think it puts more of the burden at the beginning stage, which I think is what the committee felt was important. And I really think that's all I need to say, unless people have specific questions.
All right. I think we're going to move on to the WebEx, and people can direct questions either to you or to me, and then we can see what happens. But, Tatiana, can you stay on at the end of this conference?
Oh, yes. Yes, I can.
All right.
Can I just mention that if everyone gets an opportunity and goes to the Consortium PI password-protected site and takes a look at the forms and all the policies that are posted there, that would be great.
Okay, so, Tina, are you ready?
Okay, yeah, so I can now share my desktop, okay.
All right, Okay.
So I'm just going to give a little overview of this brief presentation today, and the person who's everybody knows, Rajesh, who's going to speak about his part of this, and the person who's new to the group who's on the phone today is Kristen Jepson, who's the executive director of the Institute for Genomic Medicine, Genomic Center at UCSD. So just as a quick reminder of the AIMS 3 and 4 of the Ukraine Clinical Project, the AIM 3, which is Rajesh's piece, is to determine if a microRNA biomarker for alcohol exposure is useful as a marker of recent or distant exposure to alcohol in the human, so translating from his sheep model, and specifically, can alcohol-related maternal circulating microRNA, quote-unquote, profile be identified among women who have a history of drinking in pregnancy, and does that profile or another persist into the third trimester in maternal plasma, and or can it that profile or another be detected in the child of that mother? And do any of these microRNA profiles identified in the mother or child relate to FASD outcomes, including physical features, growth, or performance of those children? And then the exploratory AIM-4 was to explore genetic and epigenetic risk factors for FASD in the cohort sample. So do whatever we might think are genetic variants suggested by the literature or other CIFASD collaborators occur more frequently in exposed mother-child pairs in the cohort study? And then secondly, is there methylation status or other epigenetic marks associated with exposed mother-child pairs? Can we detect those in the context of the maternal and child nutritional status? So to address these aims, we began with or were drawing on the 760 unique mothers now enrolled in the study who have almost all two maternal blood samples. Some have one maternal blood sample collected to date, and then we've been collecting additional maternal saliva samples as they come in for revisit for their child evaluations, and as the children come in, as parents consent to this, we're collecting blood, saliva, or cheek cells as they agree to. And this, we're in the process of having these samples and the aliquots from Davis shipped to UCSD so that they can be banked in one central location at the Institute of Genomic Medicine. So for the pilot, what I'm calling the pilot sample selection for both AIMS 3 and 4, we determined that it would make the best sense to use the same set of mother-child pairs for this. So we began with a pool of mothers from the overall sample for which we had two blood samples, one collected at enrollment and one in the third trimester. We had completed the analysis of the maternal micronutrient status at both time points, so their methyl donor status and other micronutrient status. At those two time points in pregnancy, that the mother had a live-born child who had completed physical examination for features of FASD, and that there had been a 12-month Bayley completed for that child. So from the eligible pool, we selected samples that met criteria in three groups. They were alcohol exposed, and the mother was, and the child had met the criteria for FASD, alcohol exposed, but the child didn't meet the criteria for FASD and, in fact, had no features, none of the cardinal features, and had a normal Bayley score. And the third group, or the unexposed comparison group, was no alcohol exposure and child with no FASD. And across the distribution of the sample that ended up meeting this criteria, we looked at the balance in terms of those who had been provided the multivitamin mineral supplement or choline supplementation, and they're pretty equally balanced across the three groups, and there's a fairly even distribution across groups one and two of the quantity and frequency of alcohol exposure. So I'm going to end there and pass it off to Kristen Jepson, who's going to talk about what we're doing with the limited resources to do some of the exploratory stuff with AIM-4, beginning with the methylation piece and then moving on to the some kind of approach that might make sense in terms of looking at genetic susceptibility, and with the hope that, I mean, certainly we've talked to Tatiana and Johan about this, but others in the group, including Deepak and Kathy and Scott, might have suggestions of directions that we might go, knowing that we're beginning with the mother and then we'll be adding the child. And then Rajesh is going to talk about where he's at with the microRNA piece. And I do not think that Bing Ren was able to join us this morning. Bing is the heads the Ludwig Cancer Research Center here at UCSD. And Kristen, you can probably speak a little bit to what he's doing, this exploratory component of attempting to see if we can differentiate methylation status of the infant or the fetus from the maternal plasma sample. So I'll pass it on to Kristen.
Sure, thanks. You guys can see my desktop, right? I've never done this before.
Yeah.
Hopefully it all looks good. So Tina spoke to most of the study design questions, so I won't spend any time on that. But I'd like to let you know that we have been successful in isolating high-quality DNA from the buffy coats of these Ukrainian women. So that was good news for us, and we're continuing to finish the extraction of those samples now. You can just see in the graph at the left, these bands indicate nice, large intact genomic DNA, and the histogram plot is just a representation of those bands. And we like to look for DNA that doesn't have a lot of degradation down into these smaller size ranges, so everything looks beautiful with these samples, which isn't always trivial when you're, you know, sending samples internationally and they've been stored in multiple places. So everything looks good with the DNA sample. And the next step will be to use Illumina's Infinium human methylation 450 bead chips to assess DNA methylation. As Tina mentioned, some of these samples are the same as those that have been chosen for microRNA analysis. So a little bit about the platform we'll be using for the methylation. This is a bead chip platform. It has 485,000 methylation sites, or greater than that, covering almost the entire RefSeq gene list, with an average of 17 CDG sites in each gene region. And also covers 96% of the CDG islands, some of which are not, of course, associated with RefSeq genes. It also has some sites selected by a consortium that include non-CDG methylated sites that have been reported to be involved in human stem cell development, CBG sites that are outside of CBG islands and outside of coding regions, and also, which is interesting given our comparison to the microRNA, it has microRNA promoter regions as well. So once we generate, we haven't started generating the methylation data yet. Once we get all the DNA isolated from the buffy codes, the methylation analysis is fairly quick. We can do this in about a week, the data generation. And then once we have the data generated, we've done this for many other large sample sets from buffy coats in the past. So we'll do a basic QC to throw out any outliers that are out of range on the methylated versus unmethylated regions. In our last set of 500 samples, we actually didn't have to throw out a single sample, so we're hoping to generate the same kind of high-quality data in this project. Then we'll the analysts who are actually from UCSD's Center for Computational Biology will normalize the data using SWAN or BMIQ, which are sort of standard pipelines that we have now set up that improves the noise in the methylated data. And you can see the pre- and post-normalized data cleans up nicely. So another set of QC, since we're using buffy coats, which are made up of multiple immune cell lineages, including B cells, granulocytes, monocytes, natural killer cells, and the T cell subsets. We want to be able to compare the samples across their cell types. So, of course, the advantage of using blood or buffy coats is that they're easy to collect and store, and you can get a lot of DNA from a reasonable amount of blood, which is distinct from if you were going to sort for a particular cell type. And given, of course, the field restrictions here, it's really not reasonable to sort cells. The disadvantage, though, as I was mentioning, is that there's multiple cell types, so this can complicate epigenetic analyses, such as DNA methylation, because the different cell lineages can and will differ in their methylation. So in order to QC the data to make sure that, you know, we're comparing apples to apples, we'll take advantage of the fact that differentially methylated DNA regions can be used to distinguish these immune cell lineages with very high sensitivity and specificity. This has been published by several groups, and we've used it in other studies that we've done using buffy coats for methylation. And then we can ask, you know, sort of basic QC questions such as, do the cases and controls have an even distribution of cell types? I believe these samples come from two different sites, so we'll want to look and make sure there's no changes between the sites in the cell distribution in case there's some kind of different immune response going on in different parts of the or regions of the country. I also think that we could see differences in the women who drink versus the women who don't drink, because there's pretty strong evidence for the effects of alcohol on the immune system. So we just want to make sure that we're controlling for those types of differences and that we're not, reporting on differences in immune cells versus in changes in methylation. And we can also remove some, outliers at this point in the analysis if we feel like it's going to affect the data, such as if there are women who drink to the point where they have liver disease, they may have a very different composition of immune cells in their blood compared to women who may, don't drink as much or aren't as far along in their progression of disease related to drinking. And then once we have, the QC of this data done, we're still sort of thinking of the different ways we'll be able to compare these cases and controls. And I think as we start the analysis, more questions will come up, but we'll be looking at classes of genes that change methylation status in the fetal alcohol syndrome disorder affected and unaffected. And those may include genes that are implicated in alcohol metabolism, addiction, craniofacial development, et cetera. One interesting problem, I guess, with using fuzzy coats is, of course, these aren't necessarily the cells that you think of as the mediators of all of the effects associated with fetal alcohol syndrome, but there's fairly good evidence in the literature that fuzzy coats can be used as proxies in certain situations. There's even studies that look at dietary differences between groups and see effects in fuzzy coats. So I think we'll be able to find something, even if it's not the perfect situation, but of course it's not like we're going to be biopsying, more difficult tissue types to get a hold of here. So there's good evidence in the literature and in studies that we've done looking at psychological disorders that the immune cells can be used in these scenarios. We'll also want to compare the effect of the mother's nutritional status. As Tina pointed out, we have all of that information as well, and or their supplement assignment, whether they were in the group that was receiving folic acid supplements as part of the study, and look at the effect of this on methylation status. Does this effect differ in the affected versus unaffected? Are the regions that are, implicated in the first affected versus unaffected study associated with differential methylation in the supplement assigned or those who have better nutritional status? And I think we can ask many questions in these different areas that'll help us get at how the nutritional supplements are playing a role and how just the drinking versus non-drinking is playing a role in methylation and hopefully in outcome, in disease outcome. The second part of the AIM that we're involved in that Tina mentioned is looking at the identification of genetic variants that are associated with outcome. We haven't started working as much on this as we're still trying to pick genes. We had originally thought we'd sequence the whole exome. This is probably going to be cost prohibitive in order to get enough samples sequenced for any kind of statistical relevance. So we're starting to think about which genes we should target. It's a much more cost-effective approach. As the studies develop, we'll have more ideas of what genes to target, and we can move forward on this arena. And then I can spend just 1 second. I don't, of course, have a slide for Bing's part, but Bing has developed an assay that allows haplotyping so that you can determine which the problem with sequencing technology is that the length of the sequence that we are able to generate is quite short, around 200 base pairs, and there aren't enough variants, there aren't frequent enough variants along the length of the genome to determine whether a short chunk of DNA came from a mother or a circulating fetal DNA. Bing has developed a strategy to haplotype phase the genomic DNA from the mother and from the fetus. We're hoping that we'll be able to use that haplotype phasing to determine which DNA in the circulating blood or plasma comes from the fetus versus the mother, and then perhaps do methylation studies on that circulating DNA to help us in situations where we really aren't going to be able to get the full blood sample from the child. So he was working out the conditions to see if that's a doable or a feasible in any way. And they're very successful in methods development, so we have high hopes that he'll be able to come up with something that can help us make best use of the samples that we're able to get and ask as many questions as possible with those samples. So if anyone has any questions, I can take those now.
Yeah, I have a question about the sample sizes. Are these going to be sufficient, particularly if choline has an impact on methylation, which I think you'd expect, that to reach any conclusions, or is it just really going to be a pilot?
Well, I mean, I think we're setting it up assuming it's really just going to be a pilot. The budget is limited, so there's not much else we can do at this point, but I think there's, you know, to design further experiments downstream from what we find in the pilot. But you're probably right that we're not going to be powered to make, you know, statistically valid, relevant claims from this small of a data set.
I have a question. this is related to the methylation site. Are you going to do the whole genome body as well as the promoter, or is really targeted for the promoter?
No, it's an array-based, let me find that slide. It's an array-based methylation, and it's the CBGs are across the entire gene, so it's not just the promoter. They have sites in the promoter, the 5' UTR, the first exon, the gene body, and the 3' UTR. So it's 17 CBGs for each one of those regions. So we'll have a pretty comprehensive look across the gene.
Yeah, no, that's very good. Except the size of the sequence are pretty small, so putting them together for doing the analysis would be a humongous task.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand what you're asking.
Well, you know, you're sequencing, you said 150 base pair, right?
Oh, you know, this particular assay is an array-based assay. It's not sequencing. The sequencing assay was just where we were trying to compare fetal circulating DNA and separate that.
Okay, so how are you going to put them back together with your targeted gene? I mean, how are you going to put them with genes when you do the bioinformatics, how are you going to connect it with different genes and different pathway?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I don't know that we'll really be able to compare the buffy coat methylation to the methylation if we're able to achieve that of the circulating fetal versus mother DNA. For one thing, circulating DNA is not from immune cells, so it's just really an apples to oranges comparison at that point. But yes, I don't think that comparison will be possible. But it will be interesting to see for proof of principle if we're able to make use of the maternal blood only to look at methylation in the fetal versus mother, sort of for the next generation of experiments moving forward. These technologies are moving very quickly, so we want to stay right on the cutting edge of what we're going to be able to do, given the samples we'll be able to obtain.
Okay, I'm going to cut in here because I want to give Raja a chance. We only have about 10, 12 minutes left. Deepak, if you have any questions, I guess you can get them to Tina, who can get them.
And no, that's fine. I'm done.
Kristen, welcome to the CPAP, and look forward to the data.
Thank you.
Raj, you're on.
Okay, so I just hit share my desktop. Let's see what. Can you see my desktop?
I can.
Okay, great. So I have here with me Sridevi Balaraman, who's my colleague, who's making all of this possible. I'm going to go through the process, but if there are some very specific questions, I might turn to her as well. This is a little bit of an update on the progress report that we presented at RSA. And since then, we've to back up, we've received 140 samples from 70 women, so early pregnancy, late pregnancy plasma samples from Tina. And we're analyzing these samples, first with some quality control analysis and such, but then using a qPCR approach, which we thought was pretty stable. I know there's other approaches that we could be using, but we thought this would be a very stable approach that could also be taken to the clinic ultimately. So we're using the Exicon qPCR arrays, which screen for 760 or so microRNAs. That are the big complement of RNAs, the majority of RNAs that are expressed, known to be expressed. The other ones that are relatively rare in comparison. To date, we've analyzed 42 samples, so that is for in terms of purity and such, and 36 samples for miRNA profiles, so that is 18 patients, 18 unique patients that we've looked at so far. Overall, one of the things that we've been very worried about, well, given that it's samples coming from abroad and such, is the impact of erythrocyte lysis, because erythrocytes, and we hadn't realized this until last year, expressed huge amounts of microRNAs, and because they are 50% of the plasma volume or so, or the blood volume, they can easily contaminate things. And I'll show you some data there. On average, we're able to recover about 1,000 nanograms from the samples, which is pretty decent, and it's very constant, so there's no statistically significant effects of recruitment site or pregnancy stage. We don't know the groups. We code them as ABC. That's the way Tina sent us, so I'm just going to call them A, B, and C from now on. But there's no significant effects of these factors on RNA recovery. And that was a good thing to know. I'm going to present some statistical data as well, so bear with me here. So this is what some of the quality control looks like. We look at the plasma for evidence of free hemoglobin. Here's the free hemoglobin peak, and here's the one patient in the first trimester and third trimester samples. Here's for comparison sheep. And then here's for comparison erythrocytes, and there's these big erythrocyte peaks of deoxy and oxyhemoglobin in here that you see is completely absent. So the plasma samples are pretty clean. There's a small free hemoglobin peak, but it's actually better than we had for the sheep model. Here's some data, this is a NOVA table for those of you who are used to looking at it. The one that was a little bit, and I'll come to that in a moment, was pregnancy stage. It's near statistical significant. There's actually a decrease in free hemoglobin in late pregnancy compared to early pregnancy. But the exposure groups, recruitment stage and such, you can see that the p-values are pretty low. But I want to focus on the exposure group because even though the p-value is not statistically significant, when we look at the groups themselves, you'll see that this group C actually has a high degree of variance in its free hemoglobin. So there's something unique to this group C that I think we'll have to be concerned with, and it might there's some variable amount of hemolysis that might contribute to the plasma RNA profiles. Now that could be real depending on the treatment that this group has been subjected to, or the exposure this group has been subjected to, but we don't know as yet. And then pregnancy stage, as I mentioned, this was kind of surprising in a sense. I'd expected it to go in the opposite direction, but the late pregnancy stage actually has lower evidence of hemoglobin contamination. Now remember, these values are actually lower than what we had for our sheep data. So we're yet talking, very clean samples, despite this group C that I'm concerned with. Here's the p-values totally for the TANOVA table. So let me share with you a little bit of the other thing that we wanted to try and do, and we don't have enough in our budget to do this in a systematic way. I would like to do this better, is to look at the replicability of the data. So this is just from one sample. We've repeated it, the qPCR arrays twice. And here's an example of the replicate one and replicate two. scatter plot showing the correlation. The p-value that Pearson's correlation that we got was 0.72. It was statistically significant. If now we cut off the very low expressing microRNAs, which are a cycle threshold of 40 and above, now the correlation coefficient rises to 0.94. That's pretty decent. But I would yet like to be able to do this a few times more to make sure that we're looking at stable results when we look at these high to moderately expressed microRNAs in our profile. But this was one piece of replicability data that we have. Now, with the 36 samples that we have, here's a couple of pieces of data, the ANOVA table. We have, looking at the total number of expressed microRNAs, which to me is kind of an indication of RNA expression variability, we see a statistically significant effect right now of both recruitment site and exposure group. And here is what it looks like. Here's the exposure group. And you can see actually there's a statistical significance drop-off in the numbers of microRNAs that are being expressed in this group C compared to A, with B kind of being intermediate. This is interesting because I would have expected, given the variance in hemoglobin contamination in group C, that we would have actually seen an increase here, but we're seeing a decrease here. So my take on this is that the erythrocytes are not contributing that much to this profile in C here as yet. This is what it looks like, just in terms of what we talked about earlier, this is the recruitment site effects. So there is and I reported this earlier as well, there is a statistically significant effect due to recruitment site on the total microRNA expression, numbers of microRNA expressed. And this I think we need to keep in mind, and maybe I don't know how it'll play out with the variables others are looking at. But for us, this has been a stable effect that we're seeing here as we build the sample size. The other thing that I wanted to show you is the average expression of plasma microRNAs. And here, there is a statistically significant effect right now from the ones that we've done so far of group, but you can see none of the others are statistically significant. So group really stands out. Stage of pregnancy doesn't stand out, recruitment site doesn't stand out, and no interaction effects. And this is what it looks like if we look at the average CT. Group so C is got the highest average CT, which means the lowest expression of microRNAs. And if we normalize to group A, we can see actually group C is about a third of the average expression of group A. So this group, whatever it is very different from group A. And I'm dying to break the code at some point in time once we've done all of these things. So this is where we are to date. This is just as much as the earlier presenter, I view this as a pilot project. We're kind of trying to figure out as we go along the best approaches in terms of how we will ultimately normalize the data and things like that. I think our SHEEP project will guide us to that extent, but I don't know in terms of power, whether we will have enough power at the end, given the sample sizes we have and the variance and such. But at least it'll be it's a pilot project, and there are certain pieces of elements to the data that are holding up quite nicely so far. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer that.
Thanks, Raj. We have about 2 minutes, so if anyone has a quick question. If not, then I want to thank everybody for participating. NIAAA, any comments, concerns? It's obvious we need a lot more money.
Team of the talks.
So if you have any extra, let me know. And any science advisory board members want to weigh in, or NIAAA? Nothing? All right. Well, then I want to thank everybody, and if Tatiana and Peter can stay on for a minute, I just have an update on the 3D facial imaging thing that I need to discuss.